Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science? Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
Rules.
And ethics. And everything else.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. Now, it's a call-in show, people. If you want to be on the show, please go to askbillnye.com and type on in. I want to hear what's on your mind. And speaking of minds, this is a good day to speak of minds because we're talking about your brain. So I got a feeling that you have thought the following thought.
Like, when I see red, is it like the same red as like when you see red? Or is like what I see is green, you like see is red? And there's like no way to know what green and red is. And it's like so out there. And I got a feeling we have all wondered that. Furthermore, I hope all of you, all of us have wondered how and maybe even why we wonder anything. Why do we think about anything? What are we doing with our brain that takes all this blood and oxygen? What is it doing when we're thinking about stuff? So you're listening to this podcast, and I hope you're thinking about what we're saying. And this is a deep, deep question, which you might summarize as thinking about the nature of consciousness. What is consciousness? What sets humans apart, if indeed we are apart from other organisms with brains? So today, you know, I'm joined by our good friend Corey S. Powell. He's a science writer with an excellent brain.
Yep, that's right, Bill.
And with us today is Dr. Heather Berlin, a longtime acquaintance of mine and Corey's. And she is, I claim, I don't think this is extraordinary, among the world's foremost authorities on the physiology of the brain and the nature of consciousness. You published 50 papers in all these extraordinary journals about brains and thinking and psychology. And so, Dr. Berlin, you have strong opinions about consciousness, which are correct. Is that right?
They're all correct. Everything I say is valid.
That's exactly what we want on this show.
No, seriously, people, she has, I believe, tremendous insights, and we look forward to taking your questions as we study today the nature of consciousness, because here in our universe, science rules. Let's get started. So, Dr. B, Dr. Berlin, I have often pondered. I go to, let's say, the zoo, or I have been to the savannah in Africa, and there's a giraffe giraffing about. And I've often thought that it's a spectrum or a gradient. There would be a cockroach who behaves in some cockroachical fashion. Then above that would be dolphin, a dog. Then above that is a gorilla. Between dog and gorilla would be what? My old boss? Then above gorilla would be somebody like you or me who thinks, let's go you, who thinks deep thoughts. Now, is that a reasonable way of approaching this problem of consciousness?
Let's just start down at the basic about how far down sort of the food chain does consciousness exist?
The
brain chain. Okay. And so first you have to come up with a definition of consciousness. And what I do as a cognitive neuroscientist is I look at the relationship between the physical mechanisms in the brain, the electrophysiology and the neurochemistry, and how that correlates with our subjective states like thoughts and feelings. So that's the big question is what we're trying to explore is what are the neural correlates of consciousness?
The neural correlates mm-hmm. of consciousness.
Yes.
So how do I find a neural correlation?
So we started out just looking at things like fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, different ways to kind of peer into the brain in real time while it's active.
While the brain's still functioning.
While it's still functioning.
Like decapitating people and having a look is good as a first cut. Get it?
To look at the neuroanatomy, yes, but not to – we're interested in function, activation. So
Activation? What's activation?
Like when the brain is – when the neurons are firing. And so we have these proxy measures. Like fMRI is really just looking at blood flow to different parts of the brain. And that's
– That's nothing. Anybody could do that.
So that's just a sort of estimation of like we think where the blood goes, that's where the neurons are firing. But it's a very kind of rough estimate. But then we've started to fine-tune things and we can actually go into the brain with probes and electrodes and measure actual neurons firing. And so the whole idea was to say, if you have a thought, let's say, of your...
It happened.
It might happen occasionally.
You may be skeptical of Bill Nye having a thought, but I tell you, it's happened.
So on that rare occasion when you have a thought, let's say, of your old boss, for example, there is a specific set of neurons firing that represent that thought in your brain. And what we try to do is track that. So we say, okay, when he has this thought, we see this specific set of neurons firing. And then we can make a correlation. The philosophers call what the easy problem and the hard problem of consciousness.
Let's start with the easy one.
Okay. And this was coined by a philosopher named Dave Chalmers. The easy problem is this. If we could just track every thought to a specific or feeling to a specific set of neurons firing, like map out and make that sort of correlation, which is actually a really hard problem to solve. But theoretically, we can do that. Over time, I can map out in the brain the specific neural correlate to every thought and feeling perception that you have. But then the hard problem is, can we bridge this gap of why is it that those physical mechanisms, the neurons firing, the neurochemicals slushing around, should correspond to a subjective experience? But the basic thing is the hard problem is why these subjective states, why the brain when it's firing should feel like anything. But just to go back for a second to your original question about how far down the sort of brain line it goes, when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about simply first person subjective experience. So it doesn't have to involve language. It's just simply having a feeling, like seeing the color red or feeling pain is a good example. You don't even need self-awareness. These are all higher levels of awareness. But pure consciousness is just feeling something, having a subjective state.
So just for comedic effect, it would be like this.
That's correct. Exactly. So for example, a cat... if you look at its neural architecture, the actual physical like neurons in their brain, they look very similar to ours, similar architecture. We have a similar evolutionary history. And when you sort of step on its foot, it acts as if it's feeling something. So we assume that it has conscious states.
Are we getting to the big question?
So what the point of this is that we're moving from correlation to causation. When we used to just say, okay, you're having a thought, what's active in your brain? Now we can actually go in, stimulate parts of the brain and create a perception or a thought, create an emotion. So it's not just correlation. We can cause a feeling of happiness and then take it away.
This is science fiction. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Can you cause a perception of the color red?
Depending on where you stimulate and how you map out that specific person's brain, yes. I mean, if you're in the visual cortex and you can find the area where red is represented, if you stimulate it, we can make a person have the experience of seeing a color red or a flashing image or a memory.
So let's switch over to the outside world. We have Duncan on the line.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from New York.
Okay. Can you let us know what you're wondering?
Yeah, thank you. I've always been attracted to, I guess, what I have called a physicalist perspective on the nature of. I've always been attracted to, I guess, what I have called a physicalist perspective on the nature of existence. You know, like the only kinds of things that exist are physical, and I think for many people, it seems to imply to me that all of history is kind of predetermined, as if the universe has followed like the only path that ever could have, given the way it all began. And I guess my question was, what's your perspective on this idea of, you know, a physicalist perspective, and whether that means predetermination, and what that means for the existence of free will?
Hey, Duncan, are you familiar with the Foundation trilogy by Isaac Asimov?
I'm not.
This is where he says, if you have the premise of the bit is that if you have a huge enough population, you can make predictions just the way you could about when water would boil or any other science demonstration.
So there's a lot there. So again, I'm not a philosopher, but I can give you my neuroscientific perspective. And there's different questions between like determinism, like was everything determined from the Big Bang on, concept of free will.
Like if you knew the motion and position of every particle in the universe, in the cosmos, you could predict
everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess I'm sort of a compatibilist, I think it's called in philosophy, where it's like in between. Well, basically, there's this. Look, the brain, what we consider free will from a neuroscientific perspective, is that if everything in the environment, this is a sort of Cartesian definition of free will, is that if everything in the environment was exactly the same, the air temperature, the everything you ate, everything you did, every neuron on your brain was firing in exactly the same way, the idea that you could have done otherwise. Okay, you could have done something different. And that would mean there's sort of like a ghost in the machine or some other thing. But from a neuroscientific perspective, that we don't think that's possible. Okay, and then we can actually do experiments where we can look at the activation in a person's brain, see what is happening when they're about to make a sort of free, you know, in quotes, decision. And like, let's say even if it's something simple, go right or left. And we can do an analysis and see a buildup of brain activation that occurs in early studies about 350 milliseconds before the person is consciously aware that they're going to make even the decision.
So when you say buildup, you mean literally over time, 350 milliseconds.
Yeah, we can see
0.35
like
seconds.
We can see like a pattern of activation starting to like bring you up to a point where you're about to have the feeling that you have even an intention, not even doing the action because that takes time, but just we tell the people, okay, report exactly, see where this little ball is on this little clock going around, and just remember exactly where that was when you first had the intention to make a move. And we can predict that, you know, up to 350 milliseconds with modern technology and things like fMRI and looking at blood flow, we can predict with really good accuracy up to 10 seconds before a person is even consciously aware of whether they're going to go left or right.
10 seconds?
Yeah. With looking at the buildup of blood flow and doing a statistical analysis.
So you go from 0.35 seconds up to 10?
Well, they're different techniques. So the one was using just recording activation like EEG, and the other is now looking at blood flow. So they're two different techniques, but you can basically predict what a person is going to do before they're consciously aware of doing it. So I often would say, like, your brain can sort of make sort of free decisions, but you're the last person to know about it. We want volition. Like, we want control, conscious control. We don't really have that. Our brain is deciding all the time. Now, the other question is...
Oh, but I'm very attached to my brain. Isn't it the same as... distinguish.
Yeah. Well, your brain is basically controlling your decisions and your behaviors. And then consciousness, your sort of subjective awareness of things, is a very small little piece of it. It usually happens after the fact. The brain decides, then you become consciously aware, like, oh, I have the feeling like I had the intention to do something.
This is love at first sight kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. 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 Your brain, like, exactly.
So that's so interesting because I also... I've read a bit about the original experiments you were referencing. I think they're called the Libet experiments. And,
Libet, Benjamin Libet.
The small number of milliseconds. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Libet. And and when I read them, I was kind of skeptical because it seemed to me that it'd be hard to actually measure precisely at the level of 350 milliseconds someone's, you know, stated intention versus when the thing happens. But the 10-second thing is really interesting. Yeah. to me.
That study is by John Dylan Haynes in Berlin at Humboldt University. So if you're interested in those studies, you can look them up. But I mean, the idea, though, is that theoretically, if we knew everything about you, your DNA, your entire history, everything you've done in your life and every connection in your brain, we could theoretically predict exactly what you would do.
Is this what they call determinism?
That, in a sense, would be determinism. But, you know, there's so many variables involved that it's so difficult to predict that, you know, so just in the sense of, like, is there a ghost in the machine? Is there somebody doing the controlling? No. You know, the larger question, whether, like, everything was determined from the Big Bang on, is more of a philosophical kind of question.
Okay, let me put it to you this way. Mm-hmm. And Duncan, I'm going to ask you, please chime in a moment. So every politician, there's 400 or 500 people running for president in the U.S. right now. Each of them tells a story about this turning point, how much allowance I got when this guy told me this thing, when I took this one course with a professor. So it seems to me that's the environment influencing a person's choices in life.
Yeah.
But is there an argument that you're not even making those choices? We're not talking about left and right when there's an intersection and a pedestrian walking in front of you. We're talking about a major life choice, like where you choose to live, as you brought up earlier. Mm-hmm.
So there's actually studies which look at that, at decision making and in terms of minor things and then really big life choices. And what they find is that when you do have something called deliberation without attention, so they have it's basically your unconscious can manipulate take many variables into account. It has like an unlimited capacity. Consciousness is very limited. So if you consciously think about something, you can make a better decision if it's a simple thing, like should I buy this red oven mitt or this green one? You can have like price point in mind. You can have color, a few variables. You can keep them in conscious.
But if old oven mitt question.
Right. But if it's something like, should I marry this person? Should I take this job? Should I move here? There's so many variables involved that people, you take them in consciously. And then, you know, people say sleep on it, lie on it.
Like I was going to ask you.
Yeah. That's basically your unconscious is still working on it, but you distract yourself with other things. Don't think about it because consciousness gets in the way. And you make better decisions when you allow your unconscious that can actually operate on taking many more variables. And then sort of make a decision that way. You'll have more what we call post-decisional satisfaction.
Now, I want to put a question back to our caller, back to Duncan. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you know, we developed this beautiful theory of consciousness, this deep understanding of the brain, and we can tell you with no uncertainty, it's all predetermined. We can read your brain to such precision. We can not only tell you if you'll turn left or right, we can predict your next sentence and your next decision. How would that change your life? Would you feel different about your life if you knew that you didn't have free will in that sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a really interesting question. So my first thought is that I personally don't think it would change my life. Because I think I'm very personally prepared, I guess philosophically, to accept the fact that my brain might be actually entirely predictable, but my conscious experience is actually of making decisions, and my experience of it is at the end of the day what matters to me. But if you extend it out, I guess that's one of my questions. I was reflecting on this idea about how useful it is in humanity's interest to talk about free will in this kind of a way and the brain functioning as being this kind of predictable. And I was just thinking about like psychological studies I've read about, you know, people with like internal versus external loci of control, or like the degree to which you see yourself as in control of your own decision-making and that being a big determinant of your own personal happiness in life. Mm-hmm. And my fear would be the more people that think about their lives as being you know, their brain in control of them rather than consciously making decisions might lead to people being less happy.
Well, there are studies also which show that there are a few things. One shows that if you decrease a person's belief in free will and then you give them these tasks after, they're more likely to act unethically and to like cheat on an exam. And so the psychological, you know, free will is a psychological kind of illusion, but it's an important one that evolved for a reason, because we're humans interacting with other humans in society, and having the feeling of having agency over your own actions and decisions is both, it works with it helps you survive when you're sort of dealing with other people. It leads to more internal happiness, having an internal focus or locus of control, feeling like you have control over your actions, having responsibility for your actions. And even though we don't have free will in the Cartesian sense that I talked about, we still have, we've evolved the capacity to have self-control, right? To be able to have
some of us.
And we
some
hold people, because some people often say, like, well, if there's no free will, I can just kill somebody and it doesn't matter. You know, my brain made me do it. But we have evolved the capacity to have self-control, which is the prefrontal cortex sort of inhibiting these impulses and making adaptive decisions. And then we hold people responsible in terms of the law as well, to the extent that they have the capacity to have self-control. So if you have a huge brain lesion in your prefrontal cortex, you're going to be less responsible for your action. Or if you're a child where the prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed until around your mid-20s, you hold them less responsible for their actions. So the evolution, why we evolved this psychological illusion that we have free will, is important to survive in society. And also, you know, I think that to the extent that we have it, we hold people responsible for their
okay,
actions.
Okay, hang on a second. Duncan, both you and Dr. Berlin alluded, just sort of in passing, just, you know, sort of talking fluidly, that it wouldn't be, it's better if people don't know that they don't have free will. It's just better. We can't tell them. Let's not tell them. Duncan, do you feel that way?
That's my honest question. Yeah, what is in humanity's best interest?
But let me say, as a science educator, the less you know, the worse. This is to say, this idea of preserving ignorance is just, it never works out. It catches up with you sooner or later. But Duncan, this is a great, I mean, this is a fundamental question. Thank you, man, for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Stick around for more science rules after this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Science Rules is back.
We have a question here from Emily, a question about memory. Emily, maybe you can explain a little bit more about your question for Dr. Berlin.
Yeah, hi. So my question is, why is it hard to remember boring things, but easy to remember happy and exciting things?
I want to hear the answer to this.
That's a really good question. Well, so the brain can't remember everything. It would be overwhelming, be too much information. So it needs to be able to select what's important information to kind of remember for survival, right, for next time. And what emotions do is there's a neurochemical process where they kind of tag situations as being significant. Like, you see a tiger, you get scared and behind that bush, you should remember that that's where you saw a tiger last time.
So hang on, Emily, what's an example? Was it a tiger?
It wasn't a tiger. I thought of this helping my kids with their math homework, and we tried to just talk about it, and it just wasn't sticking. So then we made it into games, and it started sticking better, and they were had an easier time remembering it when we made it exciting.
Yeah. So there are certain sort of mnemonics or memory tricks to help kind of lay down that memory track in your brain in terms of the physiology of it. And one way is to tag it with an emotion. So, for example, if I asked you, where were you in, you know, June 20th, 1986, you might not know. But if it was like your 10th birthday party.
Well, it could have been a solstice.
Or a solstice.
June 20th.
Yes, that's the solstice.
Whoa.
I mean, it happens to be my birthday, June 20th, so I just randomly picked that date. But,
yes.
You know, if there was a significant event in your life at that day, you might remember every single detail of it. So now if you want to take something boring, although I think math is fun.
What's more exciting than math?
But if you want to make the memory stick, it's a good trick to try to add an emotion, whether positive or or negative.
So, Emily, was it fun for you to make the game fun, or was it work, and you use the expression boring, to make the game fun? Make the math fun.
Getting ready for it was definitely work, but then once we were doing it and I was able to see them remembering so much better, then that made it fun.
Fun for you?
Yes.
And maybe fun for them. Was it actually fun for them?
I think they had a good time.
Okay.
When you say had, do we not play the game of happy math excitement anymore?
Sometimes, but they are more caught up and on level, so most of their math learning happens at school now. They had some trouble in math. We're foster parents, so they had some trouble in math at first, but now are all caught up. So most of their math happens at school, and we focus on just fun things at home.
I have a tip. The teachers at school should also make math fun.
Yes, that certainly would help.
Yeah.
My teachers made math fun. And look, I'm fine.
We have another caller. Her name is Jasmine. First of all, tell me, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Berkeley, California.
Berkeley, California. There's a lot of thinking that goes on there.
Not thinking.
I was going to say, that's what they say.
Yes. It's a dichotomy. There's a little bit of both. So tell me your question.
Yeah, I'm fascinated about, you know, what's happening in the brain when we're listening, and more specifically, why it is that people tend to listen to respond rather than to understand.
What'd you say?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Yeah, that's the old more of a comment than a question thing that drives everybody crazy when you do any kind of public speaking. Mm-hmm. So Heather, what's going on there?
Okay, so yeah, a lot of the time people in a conversation, if they're not really good at communicating, they're not even listening to what the person is saying. They're just thinking about what's the next thing I'm going to say. But so there's the physiologic process of information going in, you know, through your ears and how it activates primary auditory cortex. And then there's a part of your brain called Wernicke's area, which is to do with the comprehension of language. So all that is kind of basic. But there's
cortex, Wernicke's area. It's just day at the office.
But there's attention to what you're attending to. Are you attending to what's coming into your ear, or are you attending to something internal, your own internal dialogue? But there's some interesting studies which look at communication where they do what's called hyperscanning. So they can, normally you're in a scanner, fMRI, by yourself, right? But now they have two people being scanned at the same time who can communicate to each other. So what they do is they have one person like reading a story to the other person, and then they look at how well the person who's listening comprehends, how much information they took in, how well were they listening. And what they found is that in the scenarios where they were better at listening, you saw more brain activation that was sort of in sync with the person who was reading the story. So they were, when they're attending to the story, there's some parts of the brain that are firing simultaneously in sync. And that was when the person comprehended the information. So it's not enough just to have the primary auditory cortex, like the hearing is one thing, but what you're attending to is the really important part. And so if you are in a conversation and you want to really make a effort to listen to what the other person is saying, you really have to consciously say, okay, I am going to focus and attend. And if you see your mind wandering off into your own thoughts or somewhere else, to refocus.
And now, do we know at this neurological level, at this observable level, do we actually see some brains some people are better listeners than other listeners, that some brains are better at that task than other brains?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't, you know, these were sort of snapshots in time. So we'd have to like do a longitudinal study to see if it keeps happening in the same individual and if it's really a pattern.
I have seen you, Dr. Berlin, uh-oh, make a joke about your husband's inability to listen.
That's correct. He's just turned down the volume. It's like off. I don't know if there was this film with Kate Winslet. It was like about a couple living in suburbia. It was her and Leo DiCaprio. I can't remember the name of the film. But at the end of it, there was another old couple. And this was very telling of the marriage. By the end of it,
Revolutionary Road.
That's it. Revolutionary Road.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you got that information from the recesses of your brain and not the computer.
No, I got it from the producer in the other
room.
That's
right, exactly. Revolutionary.
We call that the extended mind.
Exactly.
Well, we can have information outside of our bodies. It's not
that's
a bad
correct.
Thing. So there they are, these two actors in suburbia.
So if you see the end of the movie, I'm going to give it away. there's this old couple, and the woman is talking to her husband, and they seem like a nice old couple. And you could just see he... has this hearing aid and he just shuts down, turns down the volume. And, you know, he's sitting there nodding his head. She's talking and just, you know, there's
it's
nothing getting
mechanism.
In. Yeah.
But let me ask you this. This is a very, very common thing. Mm-hmm. And jokes have been written about it for years. You meet somebody, he or she tells you his or her name, and you just don't know what the heck, you can't for the life you remember what the person, because you must be taking in all this other stuff, yeah?
Yeah. Well, when we test, I test patients who are who are getting older, starting to have memory problems, and we give something called the Boston naming task. But what we find is that proper nouns are very hard to remember because they're not as common as words like pencil or tree or, you know, regular nouns. And so they're oddities. A name, you have to really, again, make a conscious effort to associate that name. Because if it's the first time, you don't even have any practice with it, right? Now, if it's someone you've known for 10 years, you'll remember their name, right? But it's that initial, you have to create something that's going to tag that as being important. And that's, again, like sort of referring to what we were talking about earlier. Or else it's just a random piece of information that's not that important.
Okay, now hold on. Before we move on, I feel like we are possibly guilty of listening rather than understanding. So I want to know from Jasmine, what is it? When do you have this experience? Or is this a problem that you have yourself? Or is this something that you find people doing to you where you're talking and they're not really listening? I'm curious what motivated the question.
I think it's a bit of both, right? I witness it in others and I witness it in myself, and I'm very curious about communication. So, I was just very curious about what's actually happening inside of our brains when this is happening, because I witness so many people, you know, who are asked a question and then given a response that isn't even addressing the question, which makes sense how we end up talking about two different things.
So, Jasmine, let me ask you this. Do you do this thing where you're anticipating what the person's going to say? He or she is starting a question and you stack up a bunch of possible topics, and so then you get distracted by your own topic stack?
Does that
happen to you? I mean, of course, I think sometimes when people are speaking and maybe they say something that resonates, maybe that sparks something that I want to respond with. I think luckily I have a meditation practice, so I can witness that and then, you know, come back to focus to actually hear what it is they're saying.
I have to tell you, as a reporter, one of the things that I've learned over the years is not to prepare too much for interviews, because if you prepare a lot and you have all the questions queued up, you're not listening to the response. You're just waiting to get to your next question. And actually knowing too much going in is a real problem. You know, just when the person's starting to, you know, get emotional and get connected, you ask an unrelated question because you already had that teed up in your brain. And I think that does apply in regular conversations.
So,
as well.
Jasmine, do you think everybody should meditate so that they learn to listen better?
I mean, yes, I do. Yeah.
So how many minutes do you meditate a day or a week or what have you?
I try to meditate for at least 20 minutes a day. That's like an actual formal sitting practice. But meditation for me is really about like present, you know, awareness. So I'm meditating constantly throughout the day, you know, just like coming back to my breath, feeling my feet on the ground, you know, noticing the environments in which I'm in.
It's more like a mindfulness.
That's going to ask you about that word. Yeah. That's a fad. Go ahead.
Mindfulness is kind of bringing your awareness to the present, and it's kind of focusing on the sensory information. Yeah, like where your feet are on the ground, your breath, which recenters you when your thoughts start to drift off.
What'd you say?
Exactly.
It's hilarious.
Another thing is I'm acutely aware of, I guess it's because I do a lot of communication and I can tell when the listener is wandering off. I'm really kind of hyper aware of that.
With your husband.
Exactly. And then I bring him back in. I like sort of tap him on the shoulder like, hey, excuse me, are you listening? Are you here? And refocus their attention. So it's kind of now I'm attending to many things at once, both what I'm saying and if they are attending and, you know.
Thank you very much, Jasmine. You stimulated some stimulation. Thank you.
Science Rules will be right back.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
And now, more science.
Our next caller is named Janelle. Janelle, welcome to the show. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from New York.
Ah, New York. Mm-hmm. New York, New York, the town so nice and all that?
Yes.
Okay, excellent.
Janelle, you may not know, but it's a little bit of a running joke.
Yes.
New York, New York, the town so nice, they named it twice. There, just a little explanation. Lead on.
So, Janelle, you have a question about wakefulness and attention, and tell me what your question is exactly.
I do. I have a really hard time waking up and rolling out of bed in the morning.
Oh, that's so weird.
I don't start.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't start feeling fully functional until a few hours after I've already been awake. So I guess my question is, can I somehow make myself become a morning person despite that?
That's a hard one. So there usually...
Dr. Berlin, you're doing some therapy now.
Yes.
We're at the news you can use part.
So normally when you wake up, usually it takes about a half hour, subjectively speaking, for the brain to come online. What's actually happening physiologically is you're not in a sleep state anymore. I mean, you're back in sort of beta rhythm and fully what we call an awake brain. You're not in a sleep stage. However, when you're fully awake, there's this switching between what we call the default mode network, which is what's happening when you're just relaxed and your mind is wandering and you're not really attending to anything, and the executive control network, which is like the focused attention. And when we're fully awake, we can switch very easily between these two modes. Okay, I'm going to focus now. Now I'm going to relax and release my thoughts. But in the first half hour after sleep, some studies have found that switching capacity isn't as efficient to switch between the kind of daydreamy default mode and the attentive mode. And so people are slower to kind of get online, so to speak, or to have the capacity to attend. But usually it only lasts for about, a half hour or so. But the hours and hours of grogginess, I mean, what some people do is you can go to actually a sleep lab or you can get fitted with an EEG and they can look at this different – because sometimes there's a problem in the electrophysiology of the brain and people have issues around sleep. That could be something that you take a look at.
So, Janelle, what's your relationship to coffee or tea?
I have a cup every morning and another cup every afternoon.
Is it effective?
It's Cuban coffee, so yeah, it's really potent.
So it is effective. And do you have trouble sleeping?
I do. I don't normally drink coffee after the afternoon, but I do have trouble going to sleep early.
Because a lot of times, if I understand this, if you have trouble sleeping, you have trouble waking.
Yeah, I mean, again, there are a lot of different disorders. I'm not saying this is a disorder.
You're
but
saying we can't diagnose this over the microphone?
We cannot diagnose it over the microphone in a 30-second, 5-minute call. However, they do say also if you have problems sleeping that actually no caffeine is the best thing because your body, it seeks a homeostasis and it wants to stabilize. And it actually could be better for your physiology to not put in these, foreign substances that play around with your neurochemistry. I'm just saying, but obviously, anecdotally, coffee can help.
Anecdotally, coffee can help.
Well, Heather, also, what about doing a physical activity? You wake up, going for a walk when you wake up to sort of help get your brain awake. Is that
actually is very useful. Doing some physical activity can increase blood flow to the brain, and it might help, sort of wake you up subjectively. Again, unless there's some sort of neurophysiologic problem, but that is a good strategy to start out with. On the coffee, for example, that problem I talked about, like in the first 30 minutes of waking up, you're not really, the coffee won't impact that because it takes about 30 minutes anyway for it to have its effect. And by that time, you're out of that groggy stage anyway. So that in that case, it won't really help. But the long term kind of, if you're having lethargy or tiredness for that many hours, you know, there's a lot of underlying problems that could be there.
Janelle, do you have kids?
No, I don't. I have a cat.
Ah, more than aha. So, because I know people with kids don't have a choice about when they have to get up and be alert and get going.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, that kids give you that elevated blood flow we were describing before when you hear when you know something is about to come and your adrenaline starts to rush.
Yeah.
I know people have thought about this. In the military, where people are scrambled, let's just say fighter pilots have to jump up and or fly planes. But you say, Dr. B, you're saying it takes about a half hour to rev up.
Yeah.
Janelle, you're saying it takes a few hours to rev up. Is that right?
Yeah, almost until noon is when I start feeling like my brain really turned on.
Well, that'll work out if you get up at 11:30. That'd be perfect. Be an artist.
Well, there's also other, there's hormonal effects as well. So there's different like cortisol levels sometimes peak at different times in the day. That's why often people get like around 2-3 o'clock, they get like a sort of lull in the day. So everybody's physiology is sort of on a different timer, and that could also be a factor.
Janelle, good luck. But I would look into how well you sleep. Just listening to you and being, of course, you know, an expert on analyzing people over a phone call, I would look into that. But what is amazing is that we are big animals. We're running around. We're running the freaking planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we need to sleep a third of the time.
Yeah.
What's up with that? Like, we shut things down for Janelle sleeps, and then she needs a couple more hours to rev. It's crazy.
And, and every higher organism needs to sleep, which is also crazy. But
we need a period of rest and rejuvenation. Yeah. So does the brain, the body, everything.
All right.
Well, Janelle, I hope you get the rest that you so richly deserve.
Now, Corey.
Yes.
Looking at the secret sheet, this next caller is a fascinating topic.
This is a sneak preview, but let's bring it in. We have Elaine here. And let's see, Elaine, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from New York. New York, New York.
Good. So we can compare and contrast your experience with our previous caller's experience. But you have a very different question. You have a question about hypnosis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I just want to know if it's real. Is there any science behind it?
Yes. So...
Well, thank you very much.
Great question. Okay, moving right along. No, Heather, tell us about hypnosis. I want to know.
So what really it relates to is suggestibility. And there are certain parts of your prefrontal cortex which are active when you're fully self-aware.
So hang on. Okay. Prefrontal cortex, what goes on there normally?
It's the seat of what we call executive function, which is things like attention, organization, impulse control.
Seriously, algebra problems. Is that where that goes on?
That's more parietal lobe, actually, is where we do math. But there's involvement with the prefrontal cortex as well because you have to attend.
Okay, executive function. Here we go.
Executive function. And there are different parts of the prefrontal cortex. And in particular, what's called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is involved in our sense of self. And when we feel like volition over our actions as well, that's involved. When those parts of the brain are sort of turned down, there's decreased activation, we get less of a sense of our ego, our self. It feels like information is kind of flowing through you. And when those parts of the brain are turned down, you can take on suggestions much more easily. You're right. Okay, so you can be more vulnerable to suggestions. And there are different ways to turn that part of the brain down. One is it happens during sleep, right? Certain types of drugs, things like alcohol. And if meditation, if you're in a very relaxed state, there. And so Freud had it right in a sort of kind of way where if you
can, Sigmund Freud,
if you can kind of turn down the ego and get more access to these unconscious processes. And hypnosis is one of those states where you can get somebody in a very relaxed state. And there, by the way, there are scales of hypnotizability. So some people are more hypnotizable than others. So that means they're more easily able to kind of let go and take on suggestions. And so what a lot of hypnotists do, this is a trick in the, of the trade, is that let's say they're doing it in front of a big audience. They'll say, okay, everybody close your eyes, the audience. And now imagine a balloon is tied to one wrist and a big heavy brick is tied to the other. And now slowly the balloon is lifting you up, 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 and the rock is taking you down, down, down. And you see their hands start to sort of spread out. And what the hypnotist is doing is seeing who has the biggest spread, who's the most suggestible, right? And so then when later he goes to pick an audience member, he's going to already have selected out the one who's the most suggestible that's going to take on his suggestions when he gets them on stage.
So how do they do it with the swinging stopwatch?
Right, the movie version. Is there any truth to that?
No. So
there is something about like a repetitive movement or kind of focusing a person's attention. It doesn't have to be a stopwatch.
Elaine, have you been hypnotized?
No, I haven't. I actually did get pulled up for a show once, but it did not work.
Ah, see? Okay. So that guy did not do a good selection job early on.
How did he select you or she?
I'm trying to remember. It was a long time ago. I think that it was a small group and they just said, if you're interested in trying, come on up. And then he sort of pared people down from there. So people who weren't responding well, he would tap us on the shoulder and send us back down.
Right.
Now, did you want to be hypnotized? What prompted your interest?
I wanted to see if it would work. I was so curious. Mm. I think part of it, I had a hard time understanding him actually, because the between the audio equipment and in this big space, it just didn't. I think maybe if I had been able to focus more, I'd like to think it would have worked. It just seemed so cool.
There's also like a sort of unconscious or silent agreement between the hypnotizer and the hypnotizee, and especially if it's in front of an audience, there's a social pressure to sort of obey and follow along and play along. So it's almost like you're consciously agreeing to like obey this person's commands. It's not like you're unconscious. You're there. You're just allowing them to direct your behavior.
You're consciously agreeing to give this person access to your unconscious.
In a way, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You're saying, I'm going to let go of my sort of control of my brain, my ego, and let you direct me and take on your suggestions.
Okay, let me ask you this in what I believe is a related note. Mm-hmm. I have been, in the day, I have been around magicians professionally, and every night the person picks the three of clubs on the deck of cards. Pick a card, three of clubs. Mm-hmm. And then one night, I saw that this particular magician had inscribed a representation of the three of clubs on his thumb.
Right.
And he would wave this at the person, as then I watched the guy. Mm-hmm. He would wave it at the person as he or she was coming on stage. And so there was this, if I understand it, this agreement that I'm going to go along with this magician, right, the audience member.
Right.
And then the three of clubs was presented, and then this person accepted it unconsciously. Is that a true fact or a false fact?
I mean, we're basically all always kind of taking on suggestions from our environment, and we're not conscious of all of them. So most of our decisions that we make are happening because of things that are occurring in the brain outside of awareness. And so magicians and hypnotists can sort of capitalize on that. And there's a lot of magicians who do it. Darren Brown is another one in the UK where he would actually reveal how he got this person to do what they did by putting all these little bits of information in their environment that they're not consciously aware of, but then pushes them towards making a certain decision, which they feel like they freely made.
So Elaine, are you fascinated with magicians also?
Not particularly, but I guess along the same lines. I mean, as far as hypnosis, also, just the idea of it being used for treatments also, like breaking like smoking habits or
right.
I, like on TV all the time, you see people going into hypnotherapy to, remember repressed memories and that kind of thing. Is that also possible? It seems so far.
Yeah, basically that prefrontal cortex, when it's turned on, it's we can see that process from studies. It's sort of down-regulating memories and emotions, unconscious thoughts and unpleasant memories that are still going on and affecting your behavior. And so in hypnosis, it's a way to kind of turn down activation of the prefrontal cortex so you can more easily access these unconscious processes and perhaps manipulate them so that you don't keep repeating the same behaviors, detrimental behaviors over and over again.
But can you actually implant things? I mean, this is like a movie trip that they hypnotize you and they give you a suggestion that you're going to think something or do something afterward.
In a way, yes. Yeah. I mean, like that movie, I keep referring to films, but Inception, I thought was a really good example of that, you know, going deep into a person's unconscious psyche and planting a thought or a seed and then letting it, you know, develop on its own in the person. And that's kind of what it's doing. That's kind of what we're doing. So you got to be careful with what you implant.
It is time for the lightning round.
It is time for the lightning round.
So, Dr. Berlin, you are now on the lightning spot.
Okay.
That is, that's a mixed metaphor, but the spotlight is on you, created with electricity. Best depiction of a brain consciousness in the movies?
I like Ex Machina.
The worst depiction of a brain consciousness in the movies?
Lucy or Limitless or any of those ones that say, oh, if you can only use more of your brain.
Only use 10% of our brains.
If you just take this pill,
you use 100, we'd be able to like dematerialize and fly through the air. Yes.
Total myth.
Did The Matrix get anything right?
Yes.
Okay, what? Tell us.
So the idea that we could have this whole sort of world, our whole universe is within our minds anyway. So like, for example, I think theoretically they have this thing where you can like download all the information, then all of a sudden you know karate or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, we could theoretically do that. It's all in our mind, really.
Whoa.
And we could be living in the Matrix. And yes.
Okay, if you could be any animal, like, what animal would you want to be? And I presume that's an animal that's not a human.
Is that that's a question?
Yeah.
What?
It's a lightning round question.
And you cannot cheat by saying Homo sapien.
I could be any animal. I would be a cat because they just get to, like, hang out all day, relax, sleep. They're cozy. It's chill. I just want to be a cat.
With the cat screech because I think cats are pretty anxious, really.
No, they do their own thing. You're misinterpreting cats. It's a male-female thing.
It's possible you've been hanging out with neurotic cats.
They're sketchy. They're hypervigilant. You know, they're hypervigilant. It's just a protective mechanism.
Okay. I have met cats that seem to be anything but hypervigilant, but I'm open-minded. I would want to be a well-cared-for dog. That seems like a good route.
You're a dog person. I'm a cat person.
Well, I have no issue with cats.
But dogs are just like, they're all like over the place, short attention span. They're not
What'd
really
you say?
Theoretical. Yeah. I don't know.
Do you have any food?
I'm putting in for dolphin over here.
Dolphin.
I want to do dolphin.
Thank you so much, Dr. Berlin. This has been so much fun. The nature of consciousness. I can't stop thinking about it. So I'm Bill Nye. And remember, when it comes to the consciousness part of our universe, science rules. If you like Science Rules, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out and helps other people learn about the show. Thank you. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell. Our engineers are Casey Holford, Jared O'Connell, and Brendan Burns. The mixing and original theme music is by Casey Holford. Special thanks to Claire Rawlinson. Chris Bannon is the Chief Content Officer of Stitcher, where science rules.
Stitcher.
I'm standing outside Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Inside, there are like a trillion objects, and I have to go in there and find 10.
So we open a drawer here, and there's Indiana Jones's jacket and Indiana Jones's whip.
What is this?
Now Prince donated this guitar.
I'm Asif Manvi, and I am lost at the Smithsonian. Where do I begin? This place is obviously full of fascinating stuff.
Fonzie's jacket, right? Worn by Henry Winkler on Happy Days.
There are 156 million objects in the Smithsonian's collections.
Here are Muppets.
these aren't just objects. They're pieces of America's self-identity.
I'm looking at a robe with the name Muhammad Ali.
Only 10 episodes, only 10 objects.
That's pretty amazing.
Lost of the Smithsonian is out now. Subscribe now in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.